Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the peculiar dynamic emerging in the Republican presidential primary race that has inverted the logic of who is the best leader to represent the party into the opposite, where the GOP is arguing over which of the two frontrunners are the worst candidates. Following the latest edition of the National Review titled Against Trump, which is a compilation of essays from prominent conservatives ranging from Glenn Beck to Bill Kristol to Cal Thomas, all of whom are alarmed at the prospect of Trump becoming the GOP presidential nominee, Jacob Halperin, a senior editor at the National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, joins us. We'll discuss the panic amongst the neocons over the rise of Trump, who is the only presidential candidate calling out the neocons for orchestrating the disastrous Bush-Cheney war in Iraq that cost thousands of lives and wasted untold amounts of treasure and has spawned the current Islamic State threat. Then we'll assess the implications of Vice President Biden's statements after meeting with Turkey's Prime Minister that the United States and Turkey are prepared for a military solution against the Islamic State in Syria should the peace talks planned for Monday in Geneva fail. An expert on Syria and the patchwork of militias fighting in that country's long civil war, Nicholas Harris, a Middle East researcher at the Center for Renew American Security, joins us. We'll discuss where the U.S. and Turkey's interests align and where they do not as military plans move forward to cut off the Islamic State west of the Euphrates by sealing the border between Turkey and Syria. Then finally, Nina Khrushcheva, a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, joins us in the studio for an update on the political impact of Russia's failing economy that is battered by economic sanctions, falling oil prices, and systemic corruption. We will discuss the contradiction between widespread anger across the country at the endemic corruption, while Vladimir Putin, the new czar who presides over the kleptocracy, remains popular and untouchable. And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the Ursula Hemmer Forum. I'm moderating this coming Tuesday, January the 26th at 7:30 p.m., The Migrant Tide from Syria. We'll have Jana Mason, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees Liaison to the U.S. Government, and Dawa Grisgraber, Senior Advocate for the Middle East for Refugees International, and also a Syrian refugee. Again, this coming Tuesday, January the 26th at 7:30 p.m., The Migrant Tide from Syria, free and open to the public. Join me in Westwood. And I'm joined now by Jacob Halperin, who's a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at the New Republic, and a Japan Society Fellow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Halperin.
Thank you, Ian.
So, Let me begin with this peculiar paradox that I mentioned in the opening, the inverted logic of who is the best leader to represent the party, which had been turned on its head, where the GOP is now arguing over which of the two frontrunners are the worst candidates. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
I think it's unprecedented in the GOP because for the first time you have the movement conservatives who are being outflanked on the right by Trump and are terrified by the prospect of someone even further to the right taking over the party, and they're losing control over it.
So this issue of the National Review with 22 of these prominent conservatives, as I said, ranging from Glenn Beck. By the way, just the other day on Glenn Beck's radio program, he referred to President Obama as a dumb son of a bitch. I mean, the level of or the gutter level of discourse which Trump has contributed to, I think immeasurably, is really so poisonous now. It's just beyond belief. But most of them are pretty conservative in the neocon mold. There's one or two that seem to be, you know, you've got Cal Thomas from the Christian right, and you've also got this fellow Bose from the libertarian side. But by and large, most of those people that took up the pages of the National Review, Bill Buckley's publication, were neoconservative. So is that really what's going on here, that they're just terrified that this guy is the only candidate who's actually calling them out on the disasters that they've caused?
Well, yes. I mean, the not-so-subterranean fear is that Trump would be opposed to an interventionist foreign policy abroad. And he's already made it clear that he welcomed Putin's intervention in Syria. He has been openly disdainful of the alliance with Japan. And you could easily see that Trump would seek a retrenchment in foreign policy, and so would Cruz. So this violates what has become orthodoxy in the Republican Party. Marco Rubio and others are, Chris Christie, are calling for a resumption of the George W. Bush administration policies. So I would pose this question to you, Ian. Who is the true extremist here, Trump or the neocons who actually started the Iraq War?
And have yet to be held responsible for it. And I suspect that what they're alarmed at about Trump is that he's revisiting this catastrophe in terms of what it has wrought with our foreign policy. And he also mentioned the enormous waste of money, which is into the trillions, I think about upwards of $6 trillion. You know, we've had discussions in the past about when will there be a reckoning. Well, maybe finally there might be a reckoning, but it's going to come from a very unlikely source, right? The Republican frontrunner.
Well, it is interesting because there was this libertarian or is this libertarian impulse in the Republican Party, and it seemed a few years ago that Rand Paul would be the one who would force this discussion, but he flamed out. Now you have Cruz, who's quite sophisticated as a politician, and Trump, with his coarse language, not only challenging the neocons, but ridiculing their foreign policy. And this is why the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, and the National Review, it's one of the reasons that they're going into conniptions over Trump's candidacy, because Trump could establish a completely different Republican Party. Now, to some extent, they're also being hoisted on their petard, because since when has the National Review objected to extreme right-wing candidates? I mean, they embrace the Tea Party.
Well, I think it's more ironic than that, Jacob Halbron, in as much as it was Bill Kristol who discovered Sarah Palin. He was apparently on a cruise up to Alaska, and he and Fred Barnes went ashore and met with the Governor Palin, and thought she'd be the their new standard bearer, and they sort of basically foisted him on John McCain. I foisted her on John McCain, I should say. And now she's come out in support of Trump. That's got to be really giving them conniptions.
Yeah, it is a further stinging repudiation of the neocon orthodoxy. Because you remember David Brooks was extolling Palin as a maverick politician. And now Brooks is denouncing both Cruz and Trump.
So what could happen here then? You've got, as I say, you've got this peculiar dynamic where instead of looking for the best candidates, the Republicans, all they're talking about now is who was the worst of the front runners. And the other ones, Rubio did get endorsed by the main newspaper in Iowa, but they don't seem to be going anywhere. And you keep hearing these conflicting reports about the GOP establishment. One minute they're sort of holding their nose and deciding that Cruz is acceptable given how alarmed they are by Trump. And then you hear on the other side that, you've got the governor of Iowa coming out against Cruz and basically having to accept Trump, along with a number of prominent Republicans like Bob Dole. So where do you think the needle is in terms of fluctuating back and forth between Cruz and Trump?
My guess is that ultimately Cruz is proving more palatable to the neocon wing, to the Bill Kristols and to the National Review types, because he's a little bit more traditional, and he isn't quite as vulgar and unhinged as Trump is, because Trump is beholden to no one, whereas Cruz would need the party apparatus to successfully run for the presidency. Trump, by contrast, has more of a populist appeal than does Cruz. But Cruz is personally loathed within the party. So the race is turning out exactly the opposite of the way the party elders originally envisioned it. If you remember, Reince Priebus put out a document over a year ago calling for a Republican Party that embraced minorities and that sanded off its hard edges. It's gone in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, it does seem that there's obviously a great deal of panic, but on the other hand, it's sort of, in as much as Bernie Sanders is bringing in new voters, particularly young voters, and that's obviously something that the Democrats have got to figure a way to hold on to, particularly if the Clinton machine, you know, ramps up its trashing of Bernie Sanders. And on the Republican side, you know, all kinds of people are coming out of the woodwork in support of Donald Trump. Many, apparently, according to polls, haven't voted before. So when you say the GOP is being hoisted on its own petard, I mean, all these characters that created and funded the Tea Party, they're obviously getting blowback now. But on the other hand, do they want to retain these voters, or because the minute you start, you know, trashing Trump, these followers are going to take that personally, aren't they?
Right, and the National Review apparently is losing a lot of subscribers because of its stand. One of the worries among the traditional conservatives, however, is that Trump hasn't really taken very many specific stands, and that his background is more as on the liberal side, particularly on social issues. So they're worried, in addition, that if Trump got the nomination, that he could veer to the left.
Well, there have been rumors that all along this is some incredibly clever Democratic ploy.
he's a
Trojan horse.
If you look at the National Review essays, a number of them say there's no indication that Donald Trump is actually a conservative.
Well, that's, you know, it gets you back to this kind of weird tradition in America that to be a conservative, and particularly to be a conservative icon like John Wayne and Ronald Reagan, you don't have to be authentic. You just have to be good at the rhetoric. So it sort of reinforces that notion that it's all about rhetoric, not about reality.
I mean, if you contrast Bernie Sanders and Trump, Sanders, you may agree or disagree with him, but he has put out very detailed, specific policy proposals on health care and other issues.
Oh, well, the difference between the Democratic debates and the Republican debates are different between night and day in terms of substance. But, of course, you have to also remind ourselves of this stupid, brain-dead Democratic National Committee that have buried their own debates.
That's right. But that backfired on Clinton, too.
Mm-hmm.
She might have done better if she had participated in more debates and been able to challenge Sanders more.
Sure.
She's not been able to blunt his momentum so far.
Well, just in closing, Jacob Halbron, I guess there's just no way in the world that we're not going to have some collision, but I guess in many ways it's going to be sorted out in a week or so, right, in Iowa. At least that will give some concrete texture to all this conjecture.
That's right. But if Cruz or Trump, especially Trump, wins in Iowa, it's going to be the equivalent of detonating a bomb inside the Republican Party.
Well, on that note,
it,
Sorry, go ahead.
Never faced this kind of a crisis.
Well, on that note, Jacob Harbron, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Harbron, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at The New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. We're going to take a brief station break and be back assessing the implications of Vice President Biden's statement after meeting with Turkey's Prime Minister that the United States and Turkey are prepared for a military solution against the Islamic State in Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And what did you make of the visit to Turkey by Vice President Biden, where he met with Turkey's Prime Minister and President and announced that both the U.S. and Turkey are ready for a military solution against the self-declared Islamic State if the peace talks about to begin on Monday fail?
So I think there are two dynamics at play. The first dynamic is the ongoing anti-ISIS campaign, which the administration is looking to wrap up and to really displace ISIS from the territory that it controls by the end of the administration's term. And then the second strand that's being woven here is what to do about Assad's increasingly secure rule in western Syria, which has been bolstered by the Russian intervention since September, and also an expansion in Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps-backed militias. And the administration seems to place a priority on the counterterrorism component of this two-strand strategy, which is to take the fight to ISIS.
Well, apparently the Turks have wanted to, or Erdogan has wanted to get in there in northern Syria. Of course, he seems to be more concerned about the Kurdish fighters who the U.S. are allied with and who turn out to be very effective, it appears. But apparently his military leaders have, his generals have sort of restrained him so far. But is that what the plan is? Because the Kurdish fighters are basically getting close to cutting off the Islamic State's access to the Mediterranean on the west of the Euphrates. Is that where both the U.S. and Turkey are looking at putting in ground troops?
That is exactly the area that is under discussion. It's the famous or infamous, from your perspective, Manbij pocket. It's a zone east of the city of Aleppo, west of the Euphrates. The Turks, as you know, have long feared that if the Kurdish forces were to seize control over that pocket, they would be one step closer to being able to create a contiguous zone of Kurdish domination from northeastern Syria on the Iraqi-Syrian border all the way to the area of Aleppo. There's a large pocket of Kurdish control in a region called Afrin, which is north of Aleppo, that they don't want to be contiguous Kurdish control. The question from the U.S. perspective, I mean, there's also two components here as well in terms of the anti-ISIS fight in Syria. The first is who ultimately closes the Manbij pocket and seizes control of it. And the second is, okay, once you've done that, and you've stabilized or you've secured the Turkish-Syrian border, how do you then take the fight to ISIS in its core areas of control in eastern Syria, from Raqqa to Deir ez-Zor? Because regardless of which force, whether it's the predominantly Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces coalition, which the U.S. backs, or a series of alliances of predominantly Sunni Arab Islamist rebel groups in the area of Aleppo, the Turkey backs, neither of those coalitions at this point in time has the lines of influence into core ISIS areas of controls further south and further east in Syria to displace ISIS from its rule there and then to replace it with some other type of rebel rule.
Well, one of the ironies of the current situation, though, with the Kurdish People's Protection Units, the YPG, that the U.S. is working with, and they've proven to be very effective, and they are now west of the Euphrates, which apparently alarms the Turks, but both the U.S. and Russia effectively have become their air force. There seems to be a de facto agreement amongst the U.S. and Russia in terms of both bombing the Islamic State in support of this Kurdish ground forces.
Yes, and the further irony is that in far northeastern Syria, on the Syrian-Iraqi border, around the major city of Qamishli, the United States, there seems to be ample evidence that the U.S. is building out a military air base from an existing agricultural airport there. And in that same battle space, the Assad regime has maintained one of its consistently strongest bases of control in eastern Syria. So both the United States and the Assad regime in the same theater in eastern Syria are operating parallel but not united efforts against the Islamic State. And you'll see the same sort of pattern take place further south in Deir ez-Zor governorate, where the Assad regime right now and ISIL are fighting a major, major confrontation over control of the city of Deir ez-Zor, simultaneous to which the United States has standed up an Arab Sunni tribal army called the New Syrian Army of former FSA affiliates to try to build out a military-civil movement against ISIS. So you have the Assad regime fighting against ISIS in its core areas of support. You have the United States ramping up its efforts to fight the ISIS in its core areas of support. And you have the United States and Russia both bombing ISIS in support of the Kurds. It's a very complicated situation for a complex communal civil war.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. So, of course, Nicholas, you're getting to the heart of the problem here, is that the problem when trying to end this war in Syria and Iraq is that with all of these players that you just mentioned, they're too strong to lose, but too weak to win.
Yes, exactly. And that is where we now stand in the context of the Vienna process, these diplomatic negotiations that have been ongoing, is that in many respects, the United States is trying to get the armed opposition, by the armed opposition, I mean across its regions and across its ideological spectrums, to agree to a basic political platform that supports pluralism and inclusivity, while simultaneously the Assad regime, which has been bolstered by Russian intervention and an expansion in the IRGC militias, is waging several offensives. So none of the major combatants, the armed opposition in all its various factions, or the Assad regime and its allies want to de-escalate, simultaneous to which you have ISIS, the Islamic State, which still has its core areas of control and hasn't been displaced from eastern Syria or replaced, for that matter. And then you have the Kurds. And the Kurds have built out their own administration in northeastern Syria, and many within the armed opposition, within the predominantly, overwhelmingly Sunni and Arab armed opposition, don't consider the Syrian Democratic Forces or the People's Protection Units that form the core of the Syrian Democratic Forces to be legitimate negotiators, because they fear that the Kurds are trying to build out an independent state. Part of this fear may be founded on the political influence of the Kurdistan Workers Party over a number of the Syrian Kurdish parties that are strongly representing the EPG. But part of it also may represent a certain Arab ethnic chauvinism, which has persisted in Syria since its modern history.
So I guess that explains why Vice President Biden seemed to throw a bone to Erdogan by condemning the PKK in these talks he just had in Turkey with the Prime Minister of Turkey and Erdogan. But the problem with Erdogan is that, you know, everything he's done has backfired. He supported the Islamic State, helped arm and through the intelligence service, and helped them grow, you know, turned a blind eye, if not was in complicity with the underground railroads through Turkey, through which all of these foreign fighters joined the Islamic State. Now, after a few bombings in Turkey itself, he's now rethinking that, or at least it's blowing up in his face. And the same is true with the Kurds. I mean, after all, they had a peace treaty. He broke that in order to, I think, to create a mood of nationalism in the country to help him get elected. And now he's got a mess on his hands. So how do you think Biden was able to make a deal here? Because I guess what the deal is in terms of, and by the way, if they're talking about sending in a military solution, troops on the ground, if and when, or a military solution they refer to, if and when these talks fail. Well, the talks haven't even begun on Monday. There's some doubt that they'll even get to have talks. And I think the chances of them succeeding are pretty remote, so because all these people hate each other so much. So what do you think is the nature of this deal between the U.S. and Turkey in military terms?
My analysis would be that there is that the deal, any potential deal, is still in the very incipient stages, and that what was outlined was the Turkish desire for the Kurds to not, you know, to not have a contiguous territory that could then become autonomous or independent, and the United States' desire to still be able to work with EPG, because the fact of the matter is that at this, there are two different theories of the case, conflicting with each other. There's the U.S. theory of the case, which is actually working, which recognizes that northeastern Syria, where the Kurdish forces predominate, is an ethnically and sectarian diverse area where Kurds have a majority of the population, and that regardless of whatever post-conflict scenario is built out, that the Kurds will have a major role to play, and that one of the predominant political and military forces within the Kurds is the EPG, and that that reality has to be dealt with. The Turkish theory of the case is that if the United States had provided the same level of air support to predominantly Sunni and Arab and Turkmen, and also predominantly ideologically Islamist armed opposition groups in the area of Aleppo, that ISIS would no longer control that terrain in the Manbij pocket, and that the United States has to think through empowering the Syrian Democratic Forces to close the Manbij pocket, and that there was pressure put on the United States to have the Kurds recognize that as a major red line of Turkish policy, that the Syrian Democratic Forces will not close the Manbij pocket, and that the most that the Turks will allow is that some of the Arab and Turkmen militias that work with EPG within the Syrian Democratic Forces coalition would be allowed to go into areas of the Manbij pocket that they had historically had a presence. So you have these two theories of the case contrasting with each other, but that still only focuses on the Syrian-Turkish northern border zone, and we still haven't gone to the point yet where we've talked about, you know, how do you displace ISIS from the area controls in eastern Syria, in Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa, and who will replace it? Because the unfortunate reality is that the displacement force, which may be Sunni Arab Syrians or may be some sort of international force, still has to find a replacement civil and rebel administration to prevent the rise of another ISIS state or the incursion of militant Salafist al-Qaeda groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra, which had been powerful in eastern Syria. So we have a long way to go, Ian. There's still a lot that has to fall into place, and where we're still discussing what to do with the Manbij pocket, that indicates to you some of the broader problems with crafting an effective and committed military strategy against ISIS in Syria.
Well, I think you've explained how difficult it is and how, I mean, this is only the beginning of any kind of so-called boots-on-the-ground strategy. And as you pointed out, there's a long way to go before they really take on the main target of Raqqa. But what do you make of the New York Times story on Sunday that the CIA has been working with the Saudis to supply arms to the rebels? And I guess the Saudis, their surrogates, I mean, in terms of this peace talk, they're not going to have anybody from the al-Nusra and these other more militant fronts. But apparently, what's it called, the Army of Islam or something? That's
Digital Islam, yes.
Yeah, it's in close to, on the outskirts of Damascus. That's the group that the CIA has been arming via the Saudis, right?
So the Jaish al-Islam has not received TOW missiles. The call-in card of U.S.-approved and vetted rebel groups has now become the distribution of TOW anti-tank missiles, which have had some great effect in the battlefield against the Assad regime forces in northern Syria in the area of Idlib and Hama. In terms of U.S.-Saudi cooperation, it makes total sense, as the Saudis and also the Turks have large supplies of TOW missiles that the U.S. would have to approve by law to go to vetted armed opposition groups. You bring up Jaish al-Islam, and Jaish al-Islam is a very interesting organization. As we talked about, its former leader, Zahran Alush, was killed by a regime or Russian airstrike on December 25th. Jaish al-Islam is a major center of gravity in the armed opposition in the Damascus area. In some respects, it's the center of gravity. Its political platform has generally followed the line that it seeks to impose a Sharia state on Syria after the conflict. However, its leadership has sort of been wishy-washy on whether it would actually work towards that end. Jaish al-Islam has also become a centripetal force in the armed opposition, particularly now within the Southern Front, which is a coalition of predominantly politically moderate armed opposition groups based in the southern governorates of Daraa and Quneitra and Sweda, a number of which have received TOW missiles and therefore have been vetted by the U.S. at some level. In the context of Syria, Saudi Arabia has actually played a more moderate role than Qatar, for example, or Turkey. Saudi Arabia, in terms of another organization backed by Saudi Arabia called Asala Wataniya, the Authenticity and Development Front, which is a national umbrella brand, if you will, of Islamist and some Salafist ideological militias, which also has a number of Free Syrian Army affiliates, is Saudi-backed. And it's from this coalition that the FSA affiliates that are currently being built into this new Syrian army that the U.S. is supporting with other allies to take the fight to ISIS in eastern Syria. So this speaks to the broader trend that in order to replace and then displace ISIS, there will be a strong role played by Saudi Arabia. The question then becomes, what type of role does Saudi Arabia play in Syria? Does it play an authentically more moderate, to use that phrase, role with other regional allies such as Jordan and the United States to stabilize the situation on the ground and to allow the social space for an inclusive, pluralistic rebel rule? Or does it decide out of expediency to back a different model? And that model we saw in northern Syria with the Jaish al-Fateh coalition, which took much of Idlib governorate in the spring of 2015, which has now in many areas has become a proto-state run by Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. So Saudi Arabia has played a generally more moderate role in the Syrian conflict, but it also has a checkered record when it comes to the end result of its support leading to rebel rule that is more palatable to the diplomatic process and more palatable to the goal of a post-conflict Syria that's inclusive and pluralistic.
Well, just now in the last minute then, Nicholas Harris, it would seem to me that given the intervention of Russia now extending the agony and all of the confusion and this mosaic that you've laid out for it, which is extremely complicated, it would seem to me at the end of the day it's much more likely that this war will end by sheer exhaustion as opposed to through some kind of an agreement or a ceasefire.
I'd say that sheer exhaustion is definitely one of the scenarios that's most likely. And if you look at, and to build off that point, the sheer exhaustion, in a sense, that is where U.S. policy is heading. The United States, all the statements that have come out of this current Vienna process indicate that the U.S. recognizes that Assad has his statelet centered in western Syria, that the loyalist forces have patchwork authority in other regions of Syria, including, you know, a patchwork satellite authority in eastern Syria where the current anti-ISIS battle is being waged, and that the Russian intervention and the doubling down of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps has, for the foreseeable future, solidified Assad's statelet, and that Assad's statelet is the most important chip that's being played in this Vienna process. So most calls for backing the armed opposition center around this idea of, exactly like you said, sheer exhaustion, that the way the scenario is playing out now is you're either going to have an increasingly radical, increasingly Jabhat al-Nusra lean-in rebel movement writ large that is going to be totally unpalatable to U.S. policy aims in Syria, which will then lead to Assad basically shooting his way out of the war, or alternatively, that if you don't back the more moderate armed opposition elements and you get them to become centers of gravity within the rebel movement and then make them more militarily successful, you'd force the Assad regime and, more than the Assad regime, any potential development of some sort of alternate pole of power within the current, you know, Syrian Arab Republic, to then say, okay, it's time to be serious about these talks. Okay, now it's time to look into the future and see how we can get out of this conflict. But at this stage, you have these two real contested narratives. One narrative is that Assad and his allies are going to, even if it's slowly, shoot their way out of this war, and what's going to be left are the most radical elements of the armed opposition that we wouldn't want to work with anyways. Or alternatively, those that advocate for stronger U.S. support for the moderate armed opposition as it exists now, is that you need to make them the center of gravity. You need to help them marginalize or outright defeat the more radical actors within the armed opposition ranks. Once you've done that, and most likely you provide them with some form of air support to protect them from regime and Russian airstrikes, then you begin to shift the military balance on the ground to force a real negotiation process. But at this stage, this is what it looks like, these two kind of polar choices.
Well, Nicholas Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back, joined in the studio by Nina Kusheva, talking about the political impact of Russia's failing economy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining me in the studio is Nina Kosheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She is also an editor of and a columnist to Project Syndicate and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kosheva.
Thank you.
And Nina, there are reports coming out of Russia now of a number of demonstrations right across the country. I don't know whether you remember the Academy Award film, that the Leviathan.
Of course.
I thought it was a very powerful.
It wasn't actually a winner. It was nominated.
Nominated,
for the Oscar,
yeah. Right? And it was amazing that it got as far as it did, because it was a very, very, I thought, an extraordinary window into, the corruption, I guess, in Russia. And my sense is that that's where there's a restiveness now in the outer regions that pervade across the country. There seems to be a growing. It's not directed at Putin, but it seems to be directed at either at the system or the local authorities. Is that what's happening?
It is what's happening. And it is actually really interesting that you start this conversation with Leviathan, because it's not surprising that it went as far as it did, because I think that is the brilliancy of the Putin state, is that it is a very remarkable film and it's a work of art. And when the state, because it was nominated by the state to go to the Oscars, when the state does this very clever move, it says, well, here is a critical film about the regions, mind you, and it goes to the Oscars, that means that we actually support freedom of speech, that we can seek the truth, we can actually look at the truth. And ultimately, it's really not about the Kremlin. And I think that's really a contradiction of Russia, is that on one hand, yes, I mean, the sanctions, the Western sanctions that were imposed on Russia after annexation of Crimea really is hurting economy very badly. The fallen ruble, the fallen oil prices, it's just a remarkable, remarkable strain on the Russian public. And yes, the very slowly, pensions are not paid, salaries are not paid, so people are going to the streets and actually are protesting. But a lot of it is a local problem as they are presenting it. So our Tsar, the Tsar Putin, continues to look after us. And the belief is he's going to figure it out.
But the other element, of course, is corruption, which is very much apparent in Leviathan and apparently felt across the country. The opposition character, Navalny, has made a documentary that's coming out soon. I think his estimates are that between $50 and $100 billion a year is just sort of stolen, if you will, or creamed off. So how much is the systemic corruption crippling the economy, along with falling oil prices and sanctions?
Well, it is crippling the economy. All corruption always cripples the economy. But Russia has been a corrupt country for centuries. It's not a Putin invention. I think now it's getting out of control. But so were the oil prices. They were humongous. It was over $100 a barrel. So it was also out of control. So that is crippling the economy, but not as much. I mean, I think the combination is pretty much lethal, but the greater problems for the Russians is the sanctions and the oil prices, and coupled with corruption. So when you have no money and you steal something that you do not have, then, of course, that becomes a very drastic downturn for Russia.
And again, Nina Kosheva has joined me in the studio. She's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. So when you've got teachers having their salaries slashed by a third, pensions, groceries so expensive now that things like eggplants and cucumbers are out of reach for a lot of people, these are the reports we're getting. It's obviously, there's a mantra here in American politics: it's the economy, stupid. So how does our version of the central place of economics in politics translate to Russia.
And it was the economy, stupid. And I think, one of the clever things that Putin has been able to do is that, that kind of theory of slow frog boiling. So when mm-hmm. you drop a frog and the frog into hot water and it dies right away, that it dies right away. So the economy, when sanctions were imposed and they were harsher at the time, maybe those eggplants and cucumbers would be really great indicator. And, if people would be not able to buy them right away, that would be part of the opposing movement against Putin. But it has been almost 2 years, and people kind of got used. So you take away, and then you take away, until you take away, and then the frog didn't even notice how it died. And I think that's what's happening with the economy, stupid. So that is probably the case. But I think what Putin was very cleverly once again able to do is that he made economy into history. So for Russia, it's history, stupid. So what he has done is that, Russia has suffered all the time, but we remain a great state. And I think that really has been a very successful message. So we'll see when the economy really, really, really collapses. We'll see whether people will go into the street, or there will be another little war or another little crisis that Putin will make an argument as to we need to endure this one because otherwise Russia is finished as a great nation.
Well, of course, he's already cleverly made himself indispensable in Syria because, they shut him out of the G8. The club doesn't want him anymore. He sat alone at lunch at the G20 in Brisbane after everybody had jumped on him over the shooting down of that Malaysian airliner. But he basically is forcing them to take notice of him. So he's got a few tricks up his sleeve.
But then, that's one of those very interesting ironies, because in Brisbane he was shut down, and then in Antalya, the next G20, which just happened recently, he was the man of the hour. So, in a year he was able to turn it on its head and, turn the tables back on those who tried to shun him out of politics.
Well, to get put the economy in perspective, Russia's economy, that is, it's pretty much on a level with Canada's, which is about 10th or 11th in the world economies. And, of course, we all recall Obama's dismissive remark that Russia is a regional power, but a hell of a big region from the Pacific to the Atlantic, from the Arctic to the Middle East. But when you think about, put that in the context, it's about on a par with Canada. And, of course, in the first seven or eight, the European Union, the United States, Japan, I'm just reading off the so-called U.S. allies, Germany, the U.K., France, and Italy. So not that these countries are all aligned, then the Cold War is on again, but for a big country like Russia to have an economy that's not that much better or on a par with Canada's and just above Australia's is pretty remarkable.
You mean in positive terms or negative terms?
Well, I can't think it's inescapably negative. I mean,
And that's the thing. I mean, actually, I think if you're a Russian, you say, oh, we're on the par with Canada, yippee. I think that's what sort of, and it is, it depends on how you look at it.
Right.
But Russia, as you, of course, know very well, it's a natural resources-based economy. So it would be shocking. In fact, I am actually shocked that it's on the par with Canada. I would imagine that it's on a much lower level because, and one of the reasons it's struggling so much precisely is because the oil prices are down, so Russia has very little to offer. I mean, yes, there's still aluminum, there is still gas, there's still something, but all these things really cannot provide for a viable economy that is long-lasting. So I think that is a great Russian predicament, is that it is very difficult to be all producing countries, very difficult for them to become democracies because they don't really develop. They only get out their natural resources and basically have a redistribution economy. And I think that's what Russia has to be tackling and should be tackling if it were smart, not only in creating a great nation on paper, but actually being that great nation that offers people something more than just a history of empire.
Yeah, but as the people have to tighten their belt, you know, with teachers getting one-third less of that in their paycheck. Clearly, the Siloviki around Putin are not tightening their belt. I mean, Navalny's documentary, some of the people that are portrayed in it, you know, the prosecutor general in Russia, his two sons are amazingly rich and amazingly corrupt. The Russian, the Seagulls, that was just their name in Russian. None of that's abating, is it? I mean,
And historically, it never has been. I mean, you know, because the powerful classes are the powerful classes, and then there is a proletarian or whatever they are, and so that always has been the case. So they're not tightening their belts. But, you know, it is very well known, or at least rumorly so. I mean, at least there are rumors that are very well known and probably, you know, more than just rumors that the Siloviki and those around Putin are also not entirely happy with what's going on, because a lot of them, as much as they want great Russia, they also don't want Russia that is shunned away and, you know, has to have special permission to travel if you need to and whatnot. So anybody around Putin is getting very, very nervous is that how long that kind of greatness of history can take Russia into a separate civilization, which is, you know, very difficult to sustain in the 21st century. And so I think there is a lot of discontent regardless of whether you remain rich or you don't remain rich. And another thing for us to remember is that since economy is dying and Putin is very big on keeping people at least somewhat content, even not necessarily with cucumbers, but at least sort of give an impression that he's doing something, who is paying for that? The Siloviki, those oligarchs are paying for it. So absolutely. So there's a lot of people, you know, it's like the Sochi Olympics that happened 2 years ago. I mean, they were, Olympics usually are paid by the state, but in the Russian case, they were paid by the businesses. And so it is known that the businesses are now contributing to the Russian economy and actually have to really tighten their belts in the business because their windfall of profits is no longer what they can rely on.
But, for example, when Putin's youngest daughter and her husband grab a big chunk of prime real estate, a part of the Moscow State University, that doesn't sit well with the people, does it? I mean, or you think they're just used to it?
I think they're used to it, and I think it's in some ways people expect that to some degree, and there's a lot of, I mean, Navalny did a lot of investigation on various cooperatives that Putin, his people, his children, other children are involved in, but in some ways it's not really something that people want to live well, but the fact that Putin is grabbing or somebody else is grabbing is really not very big part of their agenda because what Russians really always believe in, so this czar is going to take this, but then the new one is coming, is going to take something else.
Right.
So as long as the czar takes care of them, it's okay with whatever else they're grabbing.
Right. But, for example, when your grandfather, Nikita Khrushchev, was leader of the Soviet Union, there was a vast infrastructure of state. And of course, Stalin, there was a revolution in 1917. There was a brief moment of where the citizens had empowered themselves, but then the state took back the power. And during the Tsarist period, there was an aristocracy, a structure. There's no such structure with the Siloviki, with Putin. It's just the one guy and a handful of people that seem to sit on top of this vast country. So my sense is that because he has such absolute power, how does he get through the day having to micromanage making all those decisions? Because everything's funneled up to him.
Well, but I would slightly disagree that there is no structure because, you know, the Tsar structure was institutionalized, but it's also the Tsar who would make all those decisions. It would be indeed very similar because it would be one guy with a rather small number around him. In reaction to your mentioning of Khrushchev, and people still think that, for example, I owe which I don't. I owe vast amounts of land in Russia, and we have money because that's what the leaders do. So that's right. Sort of everybody's perception. Yeah,
but he was one of the few honest guys.
Right. He was one of the few guys who absolutely never happened to him, which is unfortunate. So I actually
unfortunate for you.
Right. It was very unfortunate. But I don't think Putin is that entirely original. It is true that in the Soviet system, there was a structure, and in the Soviet system, as corrupt as it was, you only can steal to a certain point because you cannot steal more than your position allows you. And with money, it's a very different. You can steal as much as you want. And for Putin, I think micromanaging is certainly probably that's how he spends his day. But I think also he's very targeted. I mean, he knows exactly what to look for, and he the people who are doing a lot of things for him are the ones that he can rely on, and they know exactly what he wants. Because one of the interesting things about autocratic authoritarian power is that you don't really need to almost give orders to your people. They know exactly what to do and how to please you. So all the whole country becomes part of that closed cronyism, whether you are doing it or you are suffering from it. And I think that's one of the problems that Russia has, is that it's an enclosed community that one hand washes another in more senses than one.
Well, just to in the last couple of minutes, then, to get a handle on the political impact of Russia's very stressed and failing economy, Putin, as we've established, is pretty much untouchable and is riding high. But I imagine United Russia is going to take a hit in the next election, isn't it? And my understanding is that the Communist Party is making a comeback.
Well, it does seem possible, because the Communist Party, once again, the Communist Party says, well, we know he's offering you the same as the communists, but we know how to do it, and he doesn't. And, you know, look, they promise that it's going to be all equal opportunity and whatnot. But at the same time, you know, from the example of Leviathan, it's all cronyism and corruption. So they're going to take a hit. I don't know if Putin is untouchable, because you never know in Russian politics who is going to come and say, you know what, it's time for you to go because you make us very, very nervous. And, well, the elections are only in the fall, so it's hard to make predictions right now. And another thing we know about Putin, when something he believes may go wrong, he actually starts micromanaging. He starts concentrating on that. So I think there will be a lot of resources and a lot of efforts would be put into making sure that United Russia will not fail as much as we think it may fail right now. So
sure.
It's going to be propped up and kind
well,
of
well, if they can rig the judiciary the way that they
exactly.
do, they can surely rig an election.
Exactly. I so mean. The communists are making roadways, but it's once again the it's among the certain types of the population
right.
that really doesn't represent the full country at this point.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She is an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And again, I'd like to invite you to the Isenhammer Forum I'm moderating. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.